I'm Dr. Steven Mandel. Thank you for the opportunity to tell you about ketamine infusion therapy. Ketamine is a drug of many purposes. Let me outline three of them right off the bat.
Please do.
It's among the most widely used anesthetics in the world. It was originally synthesized in 1962. By 1970, it had been approved by our Drug Enforcement Administration, FDA, as an anesthetic. It became the darling of the battlefield crowd because it's an anesthetic unlike virtually any other in that it supports respiration, it supports cardiac output, it supports blood pressure. So it's wonderful for the battlefield. There are literally thousands of people alive today because they could get a sub-anesthetic dose of ketamine, which is analgesic, meaning it reduces pain without obtunding consciousness. And they could actually participate in their own evacuation from theaters of war and get on the chopper where they couldn't have been carried there. Amazing. It became just a widely used anesthetic. It was discovered to have a peculiarity, though. It caused disassociation. Dissociation is roughly when your mind is separate from your body. Now, that sounds pretty weird. When you're waiting at the grocery store to pay for your groceries and you're thinking about what you're going to do tonight, you're dissociating. It's a big, broad spectrum. At the other end of that spectrum, if you've had just too much Aquavit and you don't know who you are and where you are, that's also dissociation, but at a very much different level. For ketamine infusion therapy, we want there to be dissociation. We want it to be more than what you get at the grocery store, but not so much that you lose track of who you are. But I'm getting way ahead of myself. So it was an anesthetic. It's 1970. It becomes the most widely used anesthetic on Earth. It's still one of the two anesthetics on the World Health Organization's list of 50 essential medicines that every government should make available to its citizens. It's a great anesthetic. By the 70s, it was also being used for its dissociative properties. Some people would say abused for its dissociative properties, but it became a recreational drug. Now, ketamine today is an anesthetic. It's a recreational drug. And in the 90s, when war-traumatized people came back to the United States from Afghanistan and Iraq and were given ketamine as an anesthetic in order to undergo surgery for their war wounds, and they woke up, many of these people having had PTSD, and they were found to be better able to sleep. They were found not to startle so much. They were found not to have so many nightmares. They didn't have to sit with their back to the wall and their eyes on the door all the time. Occasionally, they even told a joke. Well, nobody could put that together. It's so counterintuitive that an anesthetic at one dosage level would be a transformative agent and a mood elevator and a reverser of suicidality and PTSD at another level, that it took a little while for somebody to say, well, my goodness, maybe it's the ketamine. And they did some demonstration studies, and by 2000, Berman published the first good peer-reviewed journal article about ketamine as a mood elevator. And that really started a lot of people talking. It's a very potent agent in a field where the traditional medicines, the SSRIs, the SNRIs, the atypicals, the antipsychotics, take weeks, sometimes months to work, and they only work, depending on who you believe, somewhere between the low 60% and the high 40% range in patients. They also have nasty side effects, including for many patients, the development of obesity and the loss of libido. Both of things are quite depressing for people who are already depressed, not optimum. Ketamine works very fast, within hours to days. It doesn't require an ongoing administration every day. And it's not a cure, it's a treatment, but the treatment typically persists for 3+ months. It's amazing for suicidality. In our clinic, we have a reversal of depression about 83% of the time. That's a remarkable rate. In the literature, it says 70% of the time. So how come we're different? We give a little more ketamine, and we give it for a slightly longer period of time.
Right.
That's the only difference.
So I'm curious about what actually happens. I mean, besides of it being more instant than SSRI, what actually happens to a person that has, I mean, I have PTSD, so I know what it's like, but what happens to you when you go on the treatment? What actually happens in the brain or in the person?
In the brain and the person may not be, one may be a little different from the other, though of course they're related. But the person is more than the brain.
Yeah.
And the brain and the mind, the brain is a portion of the mind, if you will, in my estimation. Mm. On a biochemical or neurochemical level, what's happening is the ketamine is stimulating brain-derived neurotropic factor via AMPA or GABA or both. And the result is brain-derived neurotropic factor becomes increased in concentration, and it leads to the actual establishment of new neural connections, particularly in the hippocampus, the amygdala, the prefrontal cortex, and greater receptor density. If you picture receptors as keyholes, for every square centimeter, there are 10 keyholes, and after you give this, there are 16.
That sounds like a psychedelic. Sounds like it acts like a psychedelic as well.
I'm not sure what a psychedelic is, but it definitely is mind-altering.
Yeah.
And psychedelics, if you divide them into the botanicals, like mescaline or psilocybin or ayahuasca or ibogaine, and the chemicals, the synthesized agents like LSD, like phencyclidine derivatives, such as PCP. Mm-hmm. These agents also are psychedelic, MDMA.
Yeah.
These are very recent discoveries. The botanicals have 5,000 years of experience, but no real data. And we don't know when we take a botanical really what we're taking. And we don't know if we synthesize what we think is the dominant ingredient, how that's like the botanical and how it's not like the botanical.
Ketamine's more of a dissociative anesthetic than a psychedelic, in my opinion. And I think a lot of people would make the distinction, and with what Dr. Mandel is saying, even for the botanicals that have been around for as long as they have, we have really very little data on them. Whereas ketamine, you know, hundreds of millions of administrations over 50 years, there's a tremendous amount of safety data. Now, obviously, fewer administrations for mood disorders or chronic pain conditions than as an anesthetic, but still a substantial amount of research on it for those more recent indications. And the newer medicines like MDMA, or at least newer as far as being viewed as potential solutions to these afflictions, MDMA-assisted psychotherapy, psilocybin, the active ingredient in magic mushrooms.
Yeah.
These medicines have a tremendous potential to heal. We're only just now starting to even be permitted, at least in this country, to be able to do some really important research on better understanding the safety and efficacy of them. So ketamine really is in its own class in that way. It's also used in veterinary medicine, I wanted to add, because many people's connotation with it is a horse tranquilizer or a cat tranquilizer, and that's a very common response when you mention ketamine, and they say, "What, you're giving that to humans?"
Yeah.
Or people say, is it even legal for you to give that to people? And I always have to kind of laugh, and you know, the education gap is pretty big, even among the medical community. I recently had someone say to me, I work in medicine, I know many esteemed doctors, I've never heard of this, and it can't be real.
I've never heard of it, so it can't be real.
Yeah, and you're taking advantage of people. And I said, well, I would invite you to learn a little more. I didn't know that you and your colleagues learned of all innovations the moment that they were popularized. And it's terrible. But you know, we try to present the facts and help people to learn more when they're willing.
You make some really important points, Sam. For a variety of reasons that are fascinating that could merit an entire show or book, the United States government in the early 70s decided to interdict all of these medicines, chemicals, substances. Ketamine escaped by the skin of its teeth because it was the most widely used anesthetic in the world. The others were all interdicted. They were up scheduled to be absolutely verboten, not only for human, you know, ordinary civilians, but for people who wanted to research them. It was just not possible for any of these agents to be researched. The only reason ketamine survived, because it's wide use and as an anesthetic. It was so safe, so effective, and we get literally hundreds of millions, probably billions, of administrations over 50 years. We have a good database. One of the tragedies of banning a substance is, of course, exploration of the substance still goes on, but all information is lost, and what isn't lost is suspect because of the manner in which the information is collected and stored. It's a tragic outcome to ban something that could potentially be useful. There are many more constructive ways to modulate its use and to regulate its use.
I would really like to know how the connection between the ketamine treatment creating more neurons and the expansion of the amount of these keyholes that you talk about, how that helps someone with PTSD or an anxiety disorder or depression. What actually happens?
Okay, you asked and I started to answer on a molecular level. So you have more connections and you have more receptors. On a more macro level, you're able to go to material that either was very elusive to bring up at all, or that when you were able to bring it up, it came with it a huge amount of affect, which was very off-putting.
Yeah.
If I could make one analogy or point one thing out that may not be clear that I think could be helpful in putting the more kind of technical explanation together, is that a depressed brain or a brain with PTSD, you can actually see parts of the brain that are not functioning well, like physical measurable on a scan, that these parts of the brain that are involuted and actually not operating at a healthy level. And the processes that Dr. Mandel is describing that ketamine starts and is supportive of when it's given intravenously for an infusion at a sub-anesthetic dose, like we're doing for ketamine therapy, it actually can start to plump up and heal these parts of the brain, increase better connectivity, better function. So it's not just an experience, and there's definitely the psychological aspect, which we definitely will talk about, but it's actually causing healing and on a measurable level. And that's some of what the process is that Dr. Mandel is describing. Just wanted to point that out.
Thank you. You can make use of that enhanced brain function to look at what we say is the elephant in the room for someone with trauma.
Yeah.
Perhaps they are continually being triggered by a experience that they only dimly remember. And they only dimly remember it because any attempt to remember it with more clarity is so off-putting, is so triggering, is so alarming. The ketamine perhaps is an anesthetic for that affect. So you can experience what has been going on in terms of what actually occurred without the affect and without all the stories that have grown up in your mind around it.
Right, because the trauma is caused by an experience which was too hard or painful for the person to handle. And then it's almost like closing that trauma into a room and locking the door.
Yes.
And the ketamine is the key to open that door.
Yes. Some people do that so lock it so deeply they literally don't recollect it.
Yeah.
And we've had patients who have actually come to realize trauma during or after an infusion that they had buried for years and years and years that was literally the source of so much suffering, whether it be different people, you know, manifested in different ways with different people through substance abuse, people self-medicating, or just feeling, you know, all the symptoms of depression, PTSD, and not really even understanding why. I must be broken. It must be a chemical imbalance. You know, all the reasons from different providers or people that they could get for why they might be this way. And it turns out they have good reason. And most of us, almost every time, there is a good reason why, and there's something that can be worked out to heal from the pain that we're suffering from. And this particular patient that I'm thinking of was molested when he was younger by someone close to him. I believe it was, I don't know if it was a neighbor, an uncle. This was about 4 years ago. I don't remember the details exactly, but it was life-changing for him to come to this realization and to then be able to go to therapy to work through it and to overcome it. He was very grateful, of course. I'm sure it wasn't a pleasant thing to come to realize, but he was grateful for it.
So I did basically a version of that with trauma exposure therapy. Mm-hmm. So that was, I mean, the principle is the same. You get help to walk into that room, but I had a therapist with me holding my hand, helping me to feel safe enough to open that door and visiting the story, and almost like with her support, deflating the significance of the story.
Physician, a psychologist, is Naeem a psychiatrist?
Psychiatrist, excuse me.
Dr. Naeem is a psychiatrist friend of ours, and he talks about an analogy that when a plant is not getting water and the leaves are browning, that you don't say it has brown leaf disease. You say this plant here needs water. And that this is a beautiful analogy for modern medicine, is running around and telling people you have brown leaf disease, and you know, you have sour root disease and all this and that. And at the end of the day, most of us just need a little water, maybe some sunlight. I think, you know, ketamine really does help to get at the source of these afflictions. And it's not the end-all be-all. It's not a cure, as Dr. Mandel said. But it is a wonderful beginning to getting the energy and the relief needed to start to really look at these things and get involved in talk therapy and in healthy lifestyle changes that can help you to maintain a better life.
So how would you describe the treatment itself? What does it look like? What kind of people?
People from all walks of life.
Yeah.
All ages. All gender identifications. Most of them are functional. Some of them are really quite impaired in their ability to function. We have people who spend most of their time in bed, literally, because they're afraid or because they just can't get organized enough. It's just such an effort to do the simple personal hygiene that's necessary in getting out of the house. They come in, we take a history, we do a history, we do a physical, we review previous physicians' findings, we talk with previous caregivers, we formulate a treatment plan, which usually is 6 infusions over 2 weeks, an infusion every day, every other day, excuse me, for 2 weeks. I should go back to, our results are better than the typical clinic and the typical research study because we give a 55-minute infusion and we give slightly higher doses. After Berman's paper, the next big milestone was a guy named Carlos Zarate at the National Institute of Mental Health in 2006, had 28 patients who were resistant to all kinds of interventions, including all traditional medicines. And he gave them ketamine infusions, and 68% of those patients had relief of their depression. And that was really remarkable. It only lasted a few days, and everyone, the naysayer said, oh, what's the point of giving that medicine and going through all that if it's only going to give them 5 days? Well, for those people, 5 days was precious.
These are people who didn't respond to anything. I mean, treatment resistant, you know, severely treatment resistant. So to get a response at all was pretty substantial. But I think a lot of them also did get about 7 days, some on the higher end, 10. But
But some unsung hero said, well, let's try giving a series. Mm-hmm. And they gave 6 infusions over 2 weeks. Monday, Wednesday, Friday, Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And they chose 40 minutes for an infusion. And they chose 0.5 mg/kg of patient to be given over that 40 minutes as the dose.
0.5 mg of ketamine per kilogram of body weight over 40 minutes, yeah.
They had 71% relief. And it persisted.
For how long?
It was about 2 months.
A number of weeks. I don't think it was quite 2 months in that original study. But
I mean, for someone who's in agony and in trauma and in depression, 1 day without that is a miracle.
Yes, it depends on...
Because it creates hope as well.
Right.
Right.
It depends so much on your perspective. From the point of view of the patient, it's wonderful. From the point of view of someone who makes a competing drug, something must be wrong with it.
Yeah, I mean, also...
There's a lot of that issue.
Yeah, of course. A lot of competition.
A lot of what is really critical for a lot of these patients is to change their environment, and this really enables that. So, you know, the lifestyle choices changes, whether it's unhealthy relationships, whether it's the opportunity to try to get a job or to be physically active again, or, I mean, even in just a couple, even in 1 week, the amount of changes that can start to occur with support that can help to sustain the benefit, even when the, quote, you know, ketamine starts to wear off, is really priceless. And, you know, that's what they allege for a lot of conventional antidepressant medications, is that in theory, initially, they're going to get you to a better place, that you can make the necessary changes, and then you don't need to take them anymore. Yeah. Well, that's kind of silly. Now we see people are taking these medications daily for their entire lives, and often many combinations of them. This is not what it was, what we were sold. And I say we having friends and family who are stuck in this predicament. And, you know, it's just not, it's not ideal.
Is that what you mean with when you say that ketamine is a treatment and not a cure?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Because even we've had patients go more than 2 years before they needed boosters. Mm. But that's not typical. Typically, they need boosters after a couple of months, well, 3 months.
3 months is average. It's not uncommon for patients to go for 6 months, though. We have a number of patients who will go 6 months. And also over time with, again, the right support, therapy, lifestyle changes, as time goes on, they can increase the distance between boosters. They need booster infusions. We call them boosters for maintenance. It's usually 2 infusions done 1 or 2 days apart. To maintain the result. It's not another full series of 6.
But the same amount of one treatment?
A 55-minute infusion, is one booster, one infusion, And they typically can go longer stretches before they will need to come back for them. So if you complete a series and say you come back 3 months later for 2 boosters, you may be able to go 4 or 5 months before you come back for 2 more boosters, maybe another 6 months and so on. For people who are thriving.
One thing to mention that hasn't come up, and I think it's very important, we talk about the mind and the brain. Ketamine reverses suicidality even better than it reverses depression. And we're sharing with you that depression frequently recurs, sometimes like falling off a cliff and sometimes like going down a gentle hill. But the suicidality very rarely comes back. Hmm. And is easily, not easily, but almost always banished by a pair of boosters. The boosters will restore people to the level of relief that they had at the end of their first series. But for suicide, that's rarely necessary. People just don't go back to thinking about suicide anymore.
Oh, wow.
It's a lot easier to maintain the benefit than it is to get there in the first place. So once people are in a healthy balance, keeping them there is much easier than getting them there. Absolutely. And it is an interesting distinction between suicide and depression, and just kind of fascinating to see as time went on just how many people in some cases might actually still have some depression but would lose that urge to harm themselves and the separating those two things out. It's very powerful. And that's usually the first thing to go for patients who have thoughts of self-harm or suicide, is those thoughts dissipate. And then we kind of start chipping away at the depression.
And so I'm curious about what kind of response you get from the scientific society and from other physicians?
Oh, it's people are fascinated, ranging from them being incredulous to their wanting, hey, I want to do this too.
Yeah.
We're very strong advocates for ketamine being widely available. Depression is the biggest cause of disability in the United States. It's probably the biggest cause of disability in the world.
Yeah, I believe it is.
Literally, people are disabled by their depression. And 4% of those disabled people commit suicide every year, die by suicide.
In the U.S., it's over 44,000 every year.
25 times that number attempt suicide with horrible consequences for themselves and their whole network of people who care for them and people who they care for. You know, picture a school teacher attempting suicide, not succeeding. What about his classroom? What about his own children? What about his wife? What about his parents? What about the people in his civic associations or his PTA or his house of worship? It really has enormous impact on the community. So reversing this is an enormous contribution to everyone. And people who are interested in relieving suffering are very interested in this. On the other hand, people who have an alternative means of relieving suffering are very threatened by it.
Of course.
Because it's relatively inexpensive. It works very fast. It's super safe. It has virtually no long-term side effects in the doses used therapeutically. And for that reason, it's kind of frustrating for people who have a more expensive, less effective, taking longer to act agent.
Yeah, I mean, you look at these oral medications and, you know, 4 to 6 weeks to work. We have to adjust the dosing a little bit. Maybe we add another one. Let's come back in, you know, 4 weeks. Let's check. This tinkering around with this chemical soup to find the perfect balance that when it is perfect is really far from perfect and has negative side effects or something that works. Most of our patients, I mean, our treatment's 2 weeks, but most people benefit after the second or third infusion. There's significant relief felt usually. So we're talking within a week. None of these negative side effects. I mean, there's no comparison. Not saying that ketamine's perfect, and again, it's not a cure, but there is really no comparison.
I mean, I have to ask if you've been trying the treatment yourselves. I have to ask that.
I have not had enough depression to warrant having treatment, but I promise you, if I become depressed, I will use it.
Mm.
I have no qualms. I've given it to members of my family, and those... Most of them have responded, not all, but those who have been depressed and have responded are very grateful. And so are their spouses, and so are their employers.
I can imagine, yeah.
We have a nurse here who's been publicly sharing about having her struggles with depression and has benefited from the treatment.
And suicidality.
Yeah, benefited greatly, has really transformed her whole life. We have another staff member here who's had many of their immediate family. And, I mean, the work is personal for us with, you know, our close family and friends who have suffered from depression and suicide attempts, as well as some successful. So, yeah, it's personal work for sure.
I do want to distinguish something, though. You're suggesting that it might be fun, and yet... In a totally different dosage range, many people do seek it for fun.
For sure, yeah.
Most of our patients are not especially fond of the experience. A number of our patients find it really aversive. They don't come for the trip. They come for the relief.
No, my question was actually not from a trippy perspective, but yeah. from a medical perspective. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, no, most people find it strange or interesting. I think it's unusual for people to find it unpleasant in any way. It can be meditative. It can be spiritual.
Yes.
There's the dissociation really allows people to get an objective view on themselves and their lives and the problems that they might be facing in a unique way. So they really can kind of step outside of themselves and the difference between ketamine and a lot of the other psychedelics is, I think with other psychedelics, you can get very lost in the experience and have an inability to separate you and reality from what you're experiencing. Mm. On ketamine, most people with the doses that we're giving are able to actually have an experience and yet know that they're having an experience and that they're in a clinic receiving the medicine. And there's a level of awareness and a level of executive function and control that's maintained that's very unique to ketamine versus other psychedelics. And this can be very powerful in sorting through questions about your life, your problems, your past, your trauma, and can really allow people to be instrumental in their own therapy, or at least in the beginnings of it, with information that they can then take to a professional and work through further. Very impactful.
I mean, I imagine there's a lot of competitors that see you, what you're doing as a threat, as a competition, of course. But are there any valid arguments, any criticism that you find to be valid or right? Any arguments during
the
treatment, the work you're doing?
Well, it's interesting. We are experiencing a huge increase in the number of clinics offering ketamine infusion therapy. And one of the problems is physicians and caregivers are really committed to one of the most age-old principles is first, do no harm. And people think that if they give less, then they'll do less harm. And we have a whole bunch of people going around who've had ketamine infusion therapy at totally inadequate doses who are around saying, ketamine didn't work for me. Maybe it's a good medicine, but it doesn't work for me. And they're going on to have electroconvulsive therapy or other kinds of really disruptive and problematic interventions. I don't mean to say that electroconvulsive therapy is problematic. It's certainly a very valuable therapy for patients who have tried and not benefited from everything else, because it's the most persistent side effects of anything.
But I think that this is
the most disruptive of neural functioning. So it's, I'm sorry, Sam, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. I was just going to say, I think your point is a great one about some of the challenges of the treatment's growing popularity, but I would make the distinction that that's not really, to your question, much of a criticism of the treatment itself.
Ah.
And I hold that there really is no valid criticism of the treatment. And what Dr. Mandel's talking about now is some of the issues that are arising as it's gaining in popularity with providers who are not really adequately trained or experienced to be doing it in the way that it should be done, which is a whole other can of worms that we can talk about if you'd like. We don't have to, but underdosing is a big issue with that, as well as overdosing, and not overdosing in a lethal way, but giving people too much medicine that's counterproductive, not working, increased, you know, side effects, frightening them, making the experience so unpleasant or uncomfortable that they don't want to return for more. And these can be fatal for people, both sides of it, for people who choose not to continue with treatment or who exhaust treatment and then look to other treatments because they didn't benefit or they were scared away when they didn't really get adequate treatment. But again, back to your question, and Dr. Mandel, maybe you can speak to this as well. I don't think there's a single valid argument against ketamine when it's used responsibly and clinically for depression and other mood disorders.
Let me pop in there, because thank you for that, Sam. It's really important. And let me get clearer on your question. There are no adverse long-term side effects from ketamine infusion therapy given for therapy. People who are detractors will say, oh, yes, you get bladder problems from ketamine. Yes, you do. If you take a gram and a half or two a day for 5 years, about 20% of the group, between 15 and 20% of that group, will have serious bladder problems. Now, we're giving less than a tenth of that six times. We don't see any bladder problems. But for detractors, they say, oh, yeah, you can get bladder problems. People talked about Lewy bodies in the brain.
Oh, booger, booger.
Lewy bodies do seem to appear in the brains of primates who are given massive doses for long periods. We don't know whether Lewy bodies are an artifact of the brain staining technique for making the slides or whether they're actually a lesion. But we do know ketamine infusion therapy doesn't give Lewy bodies.
Well, it's like the study I read. There's one study about ketamine on the bladder clinically, and they took bladder cells and they soaked them in about 20,000 times the amount of ketamine for days. And then they said, look, these cells aren't looking so hot. And we're like, this is not any comparison to an IV infusion for 55 minutes of a 1/40th of a thousand, you know. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. So
cognitive impairment. Oh, yes, if you take this, you'll be cognitively impaired. Anyone who's taking any of the SSRIs, anyone who's having electroconvulsive therapy knows about cognitive impairment. Mm-hmm. Ketamine does not produce cognitive impairment.
It actually has the opposite effect for a lot of people.
It sharpens them up. The other thing people are going to say is, it's addictive. Well, Timothy Leary, the infamous, very, very actually contributory Timothy Leary, in the early 60s, nailed it. Set and setting are determinative. And we control the setting, and we influence the patient's generation of a mental set. And that is determinative of everything, whether it's a joyride or a therapeutic experience. And we've done over 9,000 infusions. We don't have anybody craving or seeking or making bad judgments in pursuit of ketamine. None.
Also, it's important to note that, you know, mindset and setting are crucial, but even with, maybe a highly addictive substance could still potentially be an issue. Ketamine's not physically addictive. It's not. That's just not the way that it works on the body. So while some people might become mentally addicted or crave it in the same way that someone can have a mental addiction to Haagen-Dazs or Ben & Jerry's or really anything else.
Chocolate.
There's sex addicts, gambling addicts, I mean, all kinds of addicts, but ketamine doesn't cause any kind of physical dependency. There's no withdrawals. It's not addictive like other substances can be.
I know, Dr. Mandel, that you need to leave soon to see to your patients, but before we end this conversation, I'm also wondering about your experience the last years. When did you start the clinic?
In 2014.
2014. So you've been at it for at least 6 years treatment.
Yeah.
And what are your thoughts about depression and suicidal tendencies and anxiety as a phenomenon in the society right now?
There's no question that it's increasing.
And why do you think? What's your thoughts on that?
It's a really complicated question. I think that devices becoming ubiquitous, particularly these things we call phones, but they're not phones at all. These peripheral brains that facilitate our being able to avoid interacting with others, the loss of intimacy, the loss of contact, the sense of isolation is really increasing. And I think particularly among youth, when we're seeing more depression and more suicidality very rapidly increasing, it's where young people are given phones and permitted to use them in a way that avoids them having to interact with other humans, whether it's coming out of their room for dinner, whether it's speaking to somebody instead of texting them. I'm not knocking the young people at all. But you asked me why I think this is happening, and I do believe it's the lack of intimacy, the lack of contact among all age groups is accelerating our isolation and our despair.
Yeah, to just add on to that, I mean, it's ironic that we're more connected than ever before, and yet more people feel disconnected from one another than ever before on a more emotional or an intimate level. And, I mean, that's not necessarily a proven fact. I don't have a source for that, but I think it's a pretty commonly accepted norm, at least in this country. And I think that among, in addition to just children, I think that adults are expected to be on all the time with work and other commitments because everyone is accessible. I know I am with this job. I'm also in the entertainment business. I'm an actor and I've been acting since I was a kid, and you're just 24/7. I mean, you get an email that you have an audition. It might be a couple hours away. The next morning, first thing, you need to respond, accept it, and be
your own audition.
You know,
you're supposed to stop what you're doing, read some lines, get them in mind, set up a camera, and shoot your own, and send it back.
And you're expected to be available and prepared all the time. Yeah. And even for this, Ketamine Clinics Los Angeles. I mean, issues come up, or you know, things that people need my attention. And, you know, you wake up and you reach over and you have text messages and emails to respond to and before bed. And it's this constant never being able to really unplug. I think that also the kind of grinding of this is glorified, again, at least in the U.S., as the hustler, the entrepreneur, the hard worker. And I think people are working more and more hours statistically in the U.S. and, you know, also being paid less as inflation and, you know, relative to inflation. And, you know, I think a lot of people feel like this rat race of spinning their wheels, just work harder and you can have the American dream, is not really adding up to the promises that a lot of people feel have been made. And it's hard.
I mean, I think it's all about a matter of diet. I read this study in a magazine a couple of weeks back that stated very clearly that it's not the amount of time you spend on your phone that's harmful or not harmful or beneficial. It's what you do. So it's like a diet. If you could eat junk food for 30 years and you'll probably die from it. But if you eat well, if you eat like fresh fruit and you drink a lot of water and you eat good food, you'll probably live a long and nice life. And I think it's the same thing with your social media diet or your iPhone diet as well.
I think that's a great point. I think both the analogy of kind of what are you putting in your body outside of just food, right? Yeah. And what are you feeding your mind?
Exactly.
And also that literally diet is a big deal too, actually.
Yeah.
I think that a lot of people are eating pretty terribly. And I think that there's a lot of negative physical and mental health effects of the American diet. And, you know, I'm not a nutritionist, but I think obesity is a real issue in this country and rising. And a lot of other diabetes and many other chronic conditions that are a result of a lack of healthy exercise. That's the other thing, too, is lack of movement. You know, people are sedentary and more the jobs are on the phone, on the computer and sitting. People as a whole aren't doing enough to get outside. You know, there's research that proves that being outside, getting sunshine, trees, we're animals who are designed to be in these environments, and we're increasingly getting less and less of what our core needs are. So I think that kind of goes back to this brown plant disease here.
For sure. I mean, a week ago, we had another guest on the podcast. His name is Ben Nempton. He's a forest guide. So he invites people to go on forest bathing.
Oh, cool.
So it's actually prescribed to do that. It helps with anxiety. It helps people to calm down their nervous system. Mm-hmm. And is those, I mean, this, I don't remember what he called those chemicals that the trees give off. Some kind of chemical that helps the body to calm down, actually. And there are these special trees that have like extra potent chemicals for that.
Yeah.
So that's called forest bathing. So there's a lot of different ways to do that.
I throw in one more thing analogous to the separation from one another that I mentioned before with our devices. As beings, we're not so integrated as we once were. Our bodies, our minds, and our spirits. We're doing our bodies in the gym. We're doing our minds in the schoolroom and in the library. And we're doing our spirituality in special places at special times of the week.
Yeah.
And that's a very unfortunate separation. This medicine and meditative and mindfulness activities and appropriate diet helps to bring the body and the mind and the spirit in touch with one another. And that is very therapeutic and very anti-depression and anti-suicide. Hmm.
So, I mean, for the people listening right now, if they want to come in contact with you and read more about the treatment and the clinic, where to go?
KetamineClinics.com. And I'll spell that. It's KetamineClinics.com. KetamineClinics.com. That's our website. We're actually completely rebuilt it out and are going to be launching a brand new version of it in the next week or two, and it's going to be beautiful. So look at it now, but come back and look at it in 2 weeks as well. And we also have a phone number. It's 310-270-0625. It's 310-270-0625, and we have staff who are here to answer any questions, and we talk to people as long as they need. We go over everything, and we're available.
Unfortunately, not all of our listeners live in California. Or
we have people coming from all over the world.
I mean, for those who
can... We had somebody from Dubai today.
Wonderful.
We've had like five people came from Australia the last quarter, last quarter of 19. We have people from Spain, from England. It's just tragic that this is not more available in people's home countries.
Yeah, I mean, 2 weeks is a possibility even if you don't live here.
So we have a special protocol for people from out of town. It's 5 days, an infusion a day every day for 5 days.
All right.
So you can get back to work and back to the family, back to your home country in only a week. It's more arduous for you. It's more wearing. It's harder on the body and on the mind than the recommended six infusions over 2 weeks. But it works. It works very well. Most of our Australian patients have stayed just a week, and they've done very well.
So next time I come back, I might try it. I might apply for a treatment.
Don't be away too long.
No, I'll definitely come back soon.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So, Dr. Mendel, thank you so much for being on the How Can We podcast.
It's really a privilege to be able to reach out to other people and to give them another possibility for their lives.
Yeah. Sam, thank you so much for being on the podcast
as well. It's my absolute pleasure, yeah. Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you.